for this May 20th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your Thursday headlines. Israel and Hamas have agreed to a ceasefire this evening. After 11 days of fighting, 12 Israelis, including two children, have been killed. For the Palestinians, the death toll is even higher at 232, including 65 Palestinian children. On Capitol Hill, a small group of progressives known as the Squad coming close to sinking the House Democrats' Capitol Security spending bill earlier today over concerns about Capitol Police accountability. The measure did pass narrowly, 213 to 212. At the White House today, President Biden signing the COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act into law. It directs law enforcement officials to better identify anti-Asian racism. If you've had a COVID vaccine, you may need a booster shot later this year. And on Wall Street today, the markets recovered. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today, all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin on Capitol Hill, where the House today narrowly passed a $1.9 billion emergency spending measure, the goal to boost security for the U.S. Capitol complex and other government agencies. The vote was a direct response to the security lapses on Capitol Hill following the January 6th attack. In an effort to improve the response for a future potential incident, the bill would allocate, among other things, $18 million for body cameras to U.S. Capitol police officers who interact with the general public. In addition, the measure includes money for riot control equipment, as well as money to strengthen intelligence and training. The bill did pass 213 to 212, with three Democrats voting present and three others opposing the bill. Those three Democrats who voted against the measure included Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, Cori Bush of Missouri, and Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts. And the three Democrats who voted present were Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, Jamal Bowman of New York, and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. They are all members of the so-called Squad, a group of the most liberal lawmakers in the House of Representatives. Now, their opposition to the bill is largely from a provision allocating more funds to the police, which would run contrary to calls on the left to, quote, defund the police. One Democratic supporter, Connecticut Representative Rosa DeLore.
Madam Speaker, I remember January 6th, as we all do. I sat in the gallery. I sat right up there. And as we counted the electoral votes, that was our constitutional duty in order to certify the election of the President of the United States. I was here when at the podium the Capitol policeman said, the rioters have breached the Capitol. They are in the rotunda. They are on their way to the House chamber, to those doors right there, and those doors that were shattered and smashed that day, and where there were barricades put up against it. We were told to grab a gas mask. I didn't know we had gas masks here. Did that, and not sooner than that, we were told, we have to evacuate you. Make your way. And I can still trace my steps around the perimeter of this gallery, all the way around, going underneath these barriers here, and all of us, Democrats, Republicans, members of the press who were there that day, young people who came here to work, we were together, we were holding on to one another because we knew there was imminent danger. And I won't ever forget us getting around to that side of the gallery when the Capitol Police said, hit the floor because of gunshots. Gunshots. And we all hit the floor, Democrats, Republicans, at the order of the Capitol Police to protect us and what was going on that day. And as I lay on the floor with very little juice in my cell phone, I called my husband. And I didn't want to say to him, I love you, because it brought back to me the remembrance of 9/11 and those last words that people uttered. And I just said, I'm fine. I'm going to be evacuated. Call the kids. Let them know it's okay. This bill is not about politics. It's not about settling scores. It's about ensuring that every person who comes onto the Capitol grounds is safe and is protected. The funding is not optional. This vote is not a show vote. It's about protecting the seat of our democracy and the men and the women and the young people who work here and serve it. I urge my colleagues, do the right thing. Pass this bill.
That from Connecticut Congresswoman Rosa DeLore just prior to today's narrow passage of the bill that does provide additional revenue to enhance security across Capitol Hill. The House Sergeant at Arms would receive $21 million, that money to beef up security and threat assessments for members of Congress. There's also funding to coordinate security for lawmakers when they travel, as well as for the installation of cameras in district offices. Representative Jamie Herrera Butler of Washington State, Republican, a member of the Appropriations Committee, urging her colleagues to vote against the measure.
I don't think any of us disagree on what we want. We want a safe and secure Capitol. We want to make sure that the people who work here are taken care of. We want to make sure that we're backfilling everything from overtime pay to mental health needs. And we want to make sure that that's all done to fix or to address some of the challenges we've had this year. But in addition, because we're talking about such a great sum of money and resources, I want to make sure it never happens again. There are other things that are happening alongside this. We've talked about the commission today. We've talked about other things. But our responsibility with this is to make sure, and as appropriators, that we're spending money and we're verifying that it's being used to the best end. That's right now ultimately what I think we can do better with. I mean, it's true right now that the Senate, both R's and D's, are not in line with what this legislation is. So if we take a little bit more time and we do this right, we can come out with something that we can all be proud of that will do the job it's intended to do. So with that, I'm very disappointed to recommend a no vote on the underlying legislation. And with that, I yield back.
Again, the price tag for the legislation, $1.9 billion. The final vote, 213 to 212. No Republicans supporting the measure. The passage comes a day after the House approved legislation that would establish a bipartisan, independent 9/11-style commission to investigate the January 6th attack. However, that measure facing an uphill climb in the Senate, Democrats would need at least 10 Republicans to vote in order for that measure to pass. More on that, the comments on the Senate floor from Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
A January 6th commission is necessary for the same reasons that the 9/11 commission was necessary. The real reason it seems Republican leaders are suddenly opposed to this bipartisan commission is they don't want to talk about the big lie at all. They don't even want to investigate how former President Trump instigated an attack on our democracy because he was angry about losing the 2020 election and lied to the American people about the results. Even now, 5 months to the day after he left office, the Republican Party is still so terrified of Donald Trump that they are apparently willing to abandon the truth and the safety of our democracy on into the future. Maybe, despite the opposition of the Republican leader, the unfortunate and sad opposition of the Republican leader, enough of my Republican colleagues will step up and join with Democrats to establish the commission. They will get a chance to do so very soon.
That from Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer, the Senate leader, earlier today. Meanwhile, Reuters.com is writing about the House GOP leader, quote, "A week after House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy gambled that he could unify his caucus by ousting a prominent critic of former President Trump, a new Trump-inspired rift has raised concerns about his leadership. 35 Republican representatives in the U.S. House, or one out of every six, joining the 219 majority Democrats in voting yesterday to create a bipartisan commission to investigate the attacks on January 6th, when hundreds of Trump supporters storming the building, fighting with police, and leaving five people dead. That was more than three times as many Republicans as voted in January to hold the president's second impeachment trial on charges of inciting that insurrection. The vote following a series of gyrations in which McCarthy gave Representative John Katko the go-ahead to negotiate the bipartisan deal, then rejected it after it became public and tried to persuade his fellow Republicans to vote against it. Again, that reporting of David Morgan. He covers Congress. It's available at Reuters.com. Now, one area of contention for House Republicans demands that leader Kevin McCarthy testify before such a committee. The House GOP leader asked about that today.
Questions, comments?
Mr. Leader.
Let's start. Let's guess. What do we have?
So,
about Cuba.
Would you be willing to testify about your conversation with Donald Trump on January 6th if you were asked by an outside commission?
Sure.
Next question.
No, not at all. I thought
it would probably be higher. But this Pelosi commission that we tried to work on for quite some time, remember,
I asked Pelosi for one on January 13th. She spent 4 months just playing politics with it. In that time period, an officer got killed on Good Friday just across with this Capitol. She didn't want to have the scope to do that as well. I just felt we're going to have four things happening right now. You've got two committees in the Senate already doing their investigation. I believe in 2 weeks they'll already have their report back, even though Pelosi wasted all this time. You've got the architect of the Capitol given $10 million to study what we need done here to protect it. And then you've got the Justice Department, rightfully does a much better job than we could ever do, arrested already 445 people, probably more, another 100 coming. That's the type of work we want to make sure done, that it never happens again, that those who participated and caused it should be held accountable, and that we secure this Capitol and we don't play politics with it. I just think a Pelosi commission is a lot of politics.
That's from Leader Kevin McCarthy, the House GOP leader. Republican hopes of blocking the bipartisan commission now in the hands of the U.S. Senate, where Republican leader Mitch McConnell has come out against the plan. With 100 members in that chamber, Senate rules would require 60 votes to advance most legislation. That means 10 Senate Republicans would have to break with their party in order to pass it. At the White House today, President Biden signing into law a bill aimed at countering a rise in anti-Asian hate crimes during this coronavirus pandemic, saying the legislation is part of the nation's first step toward unity. The law, called the COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act, would create a new position at the Justice Department to expedite the review of potential COVID-19-related hate crimes, as well as incidents reported at the federal, state, or local level. More with the president.
My message is to all of those who think this doesn't matter to them or this is not a problem, look around. Look in the mirror. Look in the eyes of your children. Every one of us are lessened. Every one of us are lessened. And we're all hurt by this hate. It has a way of seeping sort of through the cracks in the communities and children who, in fact, wouldn't have crossed their mind. Words have consequences, as the senator knows. He preaches it. He understands it. Consequences. But silence is complicity. Silence is complicity. And we cannot be complicit. We have to speak out. We have to act. That's what you've done. And I can't thank you enough. I'm proud today. I'm proud today of the United States. I'm proud today of our political system, the United States Congress. I'm proud today that Democrats and Republicans have stood up together to say something.
The bill signing ceremony at the White House, an anti-Asian hate crime bill. And this side note, and a sign of progress towards more normalcy since the start of this pandemic, this afternoon's bill signing marking the first time a large group of publicly members of Congress and other officials gathering inside the White House unmasked since the start of the Biden administration. And now to Israel, where the government today announcing a ceasefire following an intense 11-day war against Hamas militants that caused widespread destruction along the Gaza Strip and brought life in much of Israel essentially to a standstill. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announcing the ceasefire after a late-night meeting of his security cabinet. It said the group had unanimously accepted an Egyptian proposal, though the sides were still determining exactly when it would take effect. It will take effect this evening. According to the Associated Press, senior defense officials recommended accepting the proposal after claiming, quote, great accomplishments in the operation. Some background, the fighting began on May 10th when Hamas militants in Gaza fired long-range missiles towards Jerusalem after days of clashes between Palestinian protesters and Israeli police. The fighting took its heaviest toll on the Palestinian territory, where at least 230 Palestinians were killed, including 65 children and 39 women. Another 1,700 were wounded. Now, the fighting turned into a political debate here in Washington on Capitol Hill, progressive Democrats putting forth a resolution to halt the sale of $735 million worth of weapons to the Israeli government. In the House, the resolution being sponsored in part by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. And on the Senate floor, these remarks by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
I would also like to point out that those of us who are supporting an immediate ceasefire are certainly not alone. we join with nearly the unanimous call from the European Union, with United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, with Pope Francis, and with many others. In other words, all over the world, people are seeing the terrible tragedy that is taking place in the region, and they want an end to it as quickly as possible through a ceasefire. Now, I happen to have read Senator Scott's resolution, and I was particularly struck by one sentence in it on page 2. And what it says, and I quote, "The Senate mourns the loss of innocent life caused by Hamas's rocket attacks," end of quote. That was on page 2. Now, I certainly agree with that. And I think every member of Congress agrees with that. The loss of 12 innocent Israeli lives is, in fact, a tragedy. But what about the loss of 227 Palestinian lives, including 64 children and 38 women? Does Senator Scott not believe that the loss of those Palestinian lives, 64 children and 38 women among others, is not a tragedy? I believe that we should be mourning the loss of Israeli life, but we should also be mourning the loss of Palestinian lives.
That from the Senate floor, independent Bernie Sanders of Vermont. And joining us on the phone with more on this story is Avery Harper. She is the deputy political director for ABC News. A lot to talk about, but let's first begin with the developments late today, the ceasefire between Hamas and the Israeli government. At a time in which progressive Democrats have been very critical of the White House and the funding of $735 million worth of weapons to the Israeli government. If you could, put these events into context.
Right. Well, that ceasefire is welcome news for lawmakers on both sides of the aisle who wanted to see an end to the violence, which was killing civilians. In Gaza, more than 200 Palestinians had been killed. 12 people had been killed by bombings in Israel. And so, that is welcome news. What we've seen from progressive lawmakers is a criticism of Biden's stance on Israeli airstrikes in Palestinian territories. We saw earlier this week, we saw AOC, Mark Pocan, Rashida Tlaib all put forth a resolution opposing the sale of $735 million worth of weapons to the Israeli government. And today we saw Senator Bernie Sanders put forth a similar resolution in the Senate. And, what it really represents is the fact that President Joe Biden is increasingly out of step with progressive members of the Democratic Party. What we've seen from these lawmakers is them be unafraid to call him out on it. So we saw them push for, the stopping of that $735 million weapon sale. Look, it's likely going to be unsuccessful, but it was a symbolic effort to let the president know where they stand.
But where does that put the president? Because as you've indicated, progressives upset at the White House, and yet conversely, moderate Democrats and Republicans would have gone after the administration if they felt he wasn't supportive of the Israeli government and the Israeli people.
Right. I think this is really a warning shot to the president that the progressive members of his party are going to continue to hold him accountable. They are farther left than him on various topics. This happens to be about foreign policy today, but another day it will be about climate change. It'll be about health care. It'll be about student loans. And so I think what we're going to continue to see is progressive lawmakers stand up when they believe that the president has not gone far enough, is not pushing bold enough policy, and we'll continue to see these displays of defiance from progressive lawmakers.
And of course, you are following this story here in Washington, both a public policy and the political angle, but clearly the Israeli government and Prime Minister Netanyahu had to be aware of the pressure that the administration was under from these progressive Democrats.
Right. Listen, we saw the president speak to Netanyahu yesterday, and looking at that readout, the president had a slight change in tune, whereas at the very beginning of this flare in violence, we saw the president say that Israel has the right to defend itself, no ifs, ands, or buts. But later on in the week, we saw the president's words change, indicating, just how much pressure he was under from lawmakers here at home. Yesterday, he said that he wanted to see a significant de-escalation in the violence that was happening over in Gaza. But Netanyahu didn't bow to the president. He said that he was going to continue those airstrikes until the goals and the objectives of his, those airstrikes were complete. We've seen, some negotiation that was going on behind the scenes, the quiet diplomacy that the Biden administration talked about. And now that's what that's now why we're seeing the ceasefire.
As the story develops, more at abcnews.com throughout the evening. Avery Harper, she is the deputy political director here in Washington. Thank you for being with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
In other news on this Thursday, Secretary of State Tony Blinken and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov meeting for the first time since President Biden took office, the two diplomats convening on the sidelines of what's known as the Arctic Council meetings taking place this week in Reykjavik, Iceland. It's to set the stage for a future possible meeting between President Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Now, the encounter came amid increasing tensions between Washington and Moscow, both at odds on a number of fronts, including Russia's military involvement in Ukraine and Syria, its treatment of political activists, and allegations of interference in the U.S. elections. Back in April, the U.S. government imposing a number of sanctions against Russian agencies and companies and has expelled Russian diplomats over allegations tied to the 2020 election. Russia continues to deny any wrongdoing. And the White House is laying the groundwork ahead of Vice President Kamala Harris' first solo trip abroad to lead diplomatic efforts in Central America, hoping to finalize its strategy to take on some of the root causes of migration before she arrives. CNN.com reporting the following quote, "It is a high-stakes negotiation for the vice president, who in March accepted the assignment from President Biden to stem the flow of migration from Central America. Her first solo portfolio item, Kamala Harris has spoken with the leaders of Guatemala and Mexico and engaged in a number of experts on the region, both behind the scenes and publicly, all to gather information on the region and its needs." More details at CNN.com. Again, the vice president, her trip is scheduled for next month. And you're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today for this Thursday. Here are some of your other headlines. Top members of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee unveiling a bill today to reform the U.S. Postal Service. Its two key sponsors, Senator Gary Peters, Democrat of Michigan, and Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, would potentially save the post office nearly $46 billion over the next 10 years by, among other things, eliminating a pre-funding requirement for Postal Service retirees and then integrating those retirees' health care into Medicare. The bill also has the support of 10 Republican senators, appearing to give it the support needed to defeat any potential filibuster in the Senate. It would also require that the Postal Service continues delivering mail 6 days a week. And in the House today, the Ethics Committee announcing that its members have agreed to drop those $5,000 in fines issued to Democratic Whip James Clyburn of South Carolina and Republican Congressman Hal Rogers of Kentucky for their failure to complete security screenings before entering the House chamber. Now, fines for evading the metal detectors stationed outside the chamber took place after January 6th. The move today, though, by the Ethics Committee dropping the fines indicates that the decisions regarding Congressman Clyburn and Rogers was bipartisan. First Ohio and now Maryland. Governor Larry Hogan today announcing a $2 million lottery vaccine for those who have taken the vaccines across Maryland. In partnership with the Maryland Lottery and the State Health Department, Marylanders who are vaccinated will be eligible for a $40,000 prize. The random selections will take place between May 25th and July 3rd. And then Governor Hogan said on July 4th, a final drawing will be held where one Maryland resident who is vaccinated could be awarded $400,000. Now, to be eligible, the governor said you must be vaccinated, a resident of the state of Maryland, 18 or older, and if so, you are automatically entered to win. Good luck. We take an in-depth look at COVID-19 with Dr. Ashish Jha. He is the dean of the School of Public Health at Brown University. He offers his assessment on the lessons learned nearly a year and a half into this pandemic that has claimed more than 587,000 American lives. Here is part of our conversation.
Yeah, I mean, so just being very focused on this pandemic, the single biggest question in front of us is how do we produce billions of doses of these vaccines, these remarkable vaccines, in very short order? This is not a simple, like, oh, let's waive intellectual property rights. Sure, maybe that might help. But the real issues here are very complex issues of manufacturing and supply chains, and we have got to try to figure out how to solve that. That, to me, remains one of the big questions in front of us. There's a lot about this virus that we still don't understand. We don't understand why it has behaved in ways that it has at times. The virus started declining in dramatic ways in January, well before a lot of vaccines had even been delivered and into people's arms. We don't really understand what happened in India in the months leading up to this wave. I think all of us remain worried about more variants and what they will do to our vaccines. So there are a lot of challenges and questions in front of us. And ultimately, beyond this pandemic, the biggest question that I worry about, actually two, one is on a scientific basis, what's next? And how do we prepare our world for building vaccines and therapeutics for a virus that we may have never heard of before? And what's does that scientific enterprise need to look like? And then the second is, how do we maintain social cohesion? One of the things that really hurt us as a country was the way we were divided on this pandemic. And we need to be able to fight pandemics in a much more united way than we did. So there is some real work ahead of us to be able to come together as a country fighting these things and not fighting each other. Those are long-term challenges that we've got to grapple with.
You can listen to more of our conversation with Dr. Ashish Jha. He is the dean of the School of Public Health at Brown University on our podcast, The Weekly. Be sure to listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast. And there is this headline at Axios.com, vaccine boosters coming as soon as September. With more on that story, health reporter Caitlin Owens joining us on the phone. What have you learned?
So I talked to both CEOs of both Pfizer and Moderna separately, and they were both in agreement that we could require, or some of us, the first Americans, could require a third booster shot as soon as September. And so those would be the people who got their shots in December, January. You know, the thinking is that, it's important to say up front, we don't know yet how long these vaccines last for. But the thinking is that you could need a booster as soon as 8 months to a year after your first round of shots. And so, yeah, as the CEOs pointed out, I guess it's just math. Count 8 months from December, January, and you're at September.
Are you getting a sense that this is going to be the new norm as we move ahead? Because as we've talked to leading experts, including Dr. Jha, who said that we could be dealing with COVID-19 for the next 5 to 8 years.
Right. And I think it is important to reiterate, we really don't know yet. This is an area of intense research interest, as you can imagine. But the question is, well, there's two questions, really. How long does the protection from the vaccines last? Does it begin to fade, and when? And the when is just as important as the if, because vaccines last for different amounts of time. And the fact that these are so new, we just don't have evidence yet of how long they last. The other variable here is whether in the future there is some variant of the coronavirus that requires a different kind of vaccine or a booster of a different version of the vaccine. So I think that experts, you know, they think it's between possible and likely that we'll need at least one booster, or, you know, boosters for years to come. But there's no need to freak out. It's just something that we're all keeping an eye on, and we should all be aware that at some point in the next year or so, we could all require another shot.
One other follow-up based on your reporting and your conversations with the CEOs of both Pfizer and Moderna, because you write that any decline in protection would be gradual. So what are researchers looking for? What kind of data do they want to gather?
So the science is very complicated. As if you talk to virologists, it'll become eminently clear. But the bottom line is that what we'll be looking for is any kind of diminishing protection. So are there more breakthrough infections among people who have been vaccinated? Does that protection decrease? And so there's a lot of different parts of the immune system that they're looking at here. And I'll be honest, I'm not a scientist. It goes above my head. But basically, we're just trying to figure out the answer to the question. Your body's response, the level of protection it provides over time, does that go away and when? But as you said, it is gradual. And so there is no need, even if you got vaccinated in December, there is no need to worry that you're going to wake up tomorrow and no longer be protected.
But bottom line, for those who've had the two shots, a third booster shot is likely into the fall, and that could be the new norm, something that these CEOs are not alarmed about, correct?
They're definitely not alarmed about it. They're predicting September. Other experts are saying it's possible. We don't want to set a date yet because we just don't know. But yes, it is something that we should all be aware of, that as we head into the fall, I mean, I just got my second shot. I just became protected. And so I could be, I don't even know what 8 months from now is, but my third shot, if I need one, could be a long time from now. But it's just something that we should all pay attention to. And the science is underway. We'll have the information. So even if you are a healthcare worker or an older American or someone more vulnerable, who got vaccinated a long time ago, there's no reason to freak out at all.
More details at Axios.com. Caitlin Owens, who covers the healthcare industry, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And it was infrastructure which was front and center before the Senate Banking Committee today. Two of the president's cabinet secretaries leading the push, led by Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg and the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Secretary Marcia Fudge. The two urging members of the Senate Banking Committee to think broadly about what an infrastructure package would look like and what it would do. The two contend it's not just roads, bridges, railways, and waterways, but also support systems for families and communities. But Republicans, including Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, skeptical of the size and scope of the Democratic package, here are his comments.
We should not pay for a big infrastructure package by borrowing or printing hundreds of billions of more dollars. Now, the good news on this front is we have hundreds of billions of unspent COVID-related legislated funds that Congress can repurpose to pay for the infrastructure. According to CBO, over $700 billion just of the Democrats' March so-called COVID bill won't be spent even by the end of this year. And in fact, the Biden administration has already begun repurposing unneeded excess COVID funds from previous bills. HHS has diverted $1.7 billion that was originally meant for COVID, and they're using that instead for unaccompanied minors at the border. So what Congress should not do is simply go on a spending binge of more taxpayer dollars on a liberal wish list that expands the welfare state.
And that from Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, who announced earlier this year he is retiring at the end of next year. We'll get more background on the behind-the-scenes negotiations of this infrastructure bill with Eric Wasson. He is covering the story for Bloomberg News. But first, the comments of the Transportation Secretary, Pete Buttigieg.
As we rebuild from the worst economic crisis in generations, this plan will provide the largest investment in American jobs since World War II, all with protections for existing labor standards. It will create millions of good-paying jobs, the majority of which will not require a college degree, for Americans to help expand and operate our public transit system, modernize our roads and bridges, and build the electric vehicles of the future. It will double federal investment, $85 billion, for public transit, making it a more reliable, attractive, and accessible option to more people in more communities. It will help us tackle the climate crisis by making public transit the option of choice for more people, by building a network of 500,000 electric vehicle chargers, and by replacing nearly 40% of the existing diesel transit vehicle fleet with electric vehicles. Chairman Brown, I thank you for your leadership on reducing fossil fuel emissions in the transportation sector and for ensuring that the vehicles of the future are built by union workers here in the U.S. This plan would also be the largest investment in transportation equity in history. At least 40% of the benefits of the plan's climate investments will flow to overburdened and underserved communities, and the plan has $20 billion to reconnect neighborhoods cut off by past transportation decisions, as well as another $20 billion to improve road safety for all users. I believe this is the best chance in our lifetime to modernize our infrastructure so Americans can thrive. Our chance to provide current and future generations with the types of investments our forebears gave us in the New Deal, and this time to include all Americans in the opportunities that come from that investment.
The testimony earlier today of Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, it's available on our website at cspan.org. And joining us on Capitol Hill this Thursday is Eric Wasson, congressional reporter for Bloomberg News. Let's begin with the negotiations on the Senate side among Senate Republicans and Democrats. Based on what you're hearing, where do things stand?
Well, you know, I think there was an interesting comment from Senator Pat Toomey, who's a ranking member on the Bank Committee, during the Buttigieg and Fudge hearing, where he said a bipartisan deal is possible, you know, if certain conditions are met. And what they've laid out is that they're willing to do physical infrastructure, you know, not child care, not elder care, not free public community college. And they're willing to that needs to be paid for, and it can't be paid for by, rescinding the Trump tax cuts. So that pretty much squares with what the approach has been behind the scenes. Shelley Moore Capito, West Virginia, has been leading the talks with the White House, in which Buttigieg has been participating. And she talked to us, outside the Senate floor, earlier today, and saying that, you know, they had continuing conversations. They didn't expect a White House counteroffer, but were hopeful something would come on Friday. Roy Blunt, who's also been part of the talks, continues to see, he said the dynamic, in his words, was very positive. There's a sense that both sides want to see, a bipartisan deal. He thinks, the White House sees political advantage in that, and Senate Republicans also do as well. But the question is, can the gap be bridged? And he has been suggesting that what the White House should do is take, the $600 to $800 billion that, Republicans are talking about and say, okay, well, we need to add one or two things, and then that's where we can go from there. His message basically is, if Buttigieg, as he said in the hearing, continues to say that child care and elder care are infrastructure, and then backs that up by insisting that they all go in one big package, Republicans won't be a part of that.
And, of course, the Democratic plan is close to $2 trillion. And so how do you bridge that divide between Democrats and Republicans?
Right. In fact, it's actually $4 trillion if you include the families plan, which includes similar items. What I tend to think is possible here is that the physical infrastructure, roads, bridges, transit, wastewater, water, broadband, internet, plus perhaps a few other items, gets put into a bipartisan deal with Republicans, perhaps paid for by increased tax enforcement. The Treasury Department was out today with a very interesting study explaining their number of $700 billion in new revenue over 10 years if they increase audits of the wealthy. Items like that could be used to pay for this kind of deal. And the rest of the $4 trillion menu, going through reconciliation, going through a Democratic-only process, if they can keep all the Democrats united. So, that's basically what a possible outcome is here. I do not see Republicans going much above the $600 to $800 billion level that has been outlined by their leadership.
We're talking with Eric Wasson of Bloomberg News. We heard from Senate Republicans, including Pat Toomey, critical of the price tag by the Democrats. My question, though, can you separate a proposal with the pay-fors? Because the tax increase continues to be a big source of contention among Senate and House Republicans.
Well, I think the first step will be to find out how much they need to pay for. So they want to figure out what is the overall price tag, and then get into different proposals. And then they've talked about user fees on the Republican side, which is interesting. That includes a possible gas tax increase. You normally don't hear Republicans talking about tax increases, but for them, user fees are something that doesn't violate their no new taxes pledge. Vehicle miles traveled fees that would hit electric vehicles to allow them to pay for roads that they use, even though they're not currently paying a gas tax, as well as public-private partnerships, perhaps incentivizing those and getting toll roads out there as a sort of user fee. have been talked about. There's also the idea of Build America bonds, or bonds that would allow the federal government to subsidize the interest payments on long-term bonds from states, as well as an infrastructure bank. So there are some ideas, some of it may be accounting wizardry, that could allow them to bridge the gap. And again, tax enforcement could be part of that. But certainly, the corporate tax increase from 21% to 28% that the president has talked about as a key to all of this, as well as changes to the global tax system, are not on the table for Republicans.
The headline at Bloomberg.com, President Biden saying he is willing to compromise on his $2 trillion infrastructure proposal. The reporting of Eric Wasson on Capitol Hill. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
On Wall Street, a much better day for the market. The Dow rose 188 points. The NASDAQ was up 236. The S&P closing 43 points higher. And a follow-up on what Eric Wasson was talking about, more today from the Treasury Department on corporate taxes. In a statement, the department saying corporations around the world should pay at least a 15% tax on their earnings, part of a push for a global minimum tax for businesses. The final rate could go even higher than that, according to the release by the Treasury Department, saying that the 15% minimum is a floor and that discussions should continue to be ambitious. Now, U.S.-based companies currently pay a 21% rate, but that rate could go up if Democrats, as Eric Wasson pointed out, agree to a higher tax to pay for the president's infrastructure plan. A reminder, all of C-SPAN's coverage is available on the web at cspan.org. And this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast. I'm Steve Scully for the Thursday edition of Washington Today. Hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.